If God will forgive us our sins no matter what, why not just lie and cheat and steal all the time? Another shush. But Dad... The church thing never really panned out for me. I was sneaking Nine Inch Nails t-shirts into Sunday school before my balls had completely dropped. And a couple years later, I struggled my way through my first Nietzsche book. From there, it was all downhill. I started acting out. I bailed on Sunday school to go smoke cigarettes in the adjoining parking lot. It was over. I was a little heathen. The open questioning and skepticism eventually got so bad that my Sunday school teacher took me aside one morning and made me a deal. He'd give me perfect marks in our confirmation class and tell my parents I was a role model student as long as I stopped questioning the logical inconsistencies of the Bible in front of all the other kids. I agreed. This probably won't surprise you, but I'm not very spiritual. No supernatural beliefs for me, thank you. I get a sick pleasure from chaos and uncertainty. This, unfortunately, has condemned me to a life of struggle with the uncomfortable truth, but it's a situation I've come to accept about myself. Now that I'm older, though, I get the whole dress-up-for-Jesus thing. Despite what I thought at the time, it wasn't about my parents, or God, torturing me. It was about respect. And not to God, but to the community, to the religion. Dressing up on Sunday is about virtue signaling to the other churchgoers. This Jesus stuff is serious business. It's part of the us versus them dynamic. It signals that you're an us and that you should be treated as such. And then there are the robes. Ever notice that the most important moments in life are always accompanied by somebody in a robe? Weddings, graduations, funerals, court hearings, judicial committee hearings, open heart surgeries, baptisms, and yes, even church sermons. I first noticed the robe thing when I graduated from college. I was hungover and on about 3 hours sleep when I stumbled to my seat for commencement. I looked around and thought, holy shit, I haven't seen this many robes in one place since I went to church. Then I looked down and to my horror realized that I was one of them. The robe, a visual cue signaling status and importance, is part of the ritual thing. And we need rituals because rituals make our values tangible. You can't think your way toward valuing something. You have to live it. You have to experience it. And one way of making it easier for others to live and experience a value is to make up cute outfits for them to wear and important sounding words for them to say. In short, to give them rituals. Rituals are visual and experiential representations of what we deem important. That's why every good religion has them. Remember, emotions are actions. The two are one and the same. Therefore, to modify or reinforce the feeling brain's value hierarchy, you need some easily repeatable yet totally unique and identifiable action for people to perform. That's where the rituals come in. Rituals are designed to be repeated over a long period of time, which only lends them an even greater sense of importance. After all, it's not often you get to do the exact same thing that people 500 years ago did. That's some heavy shit. Rituals are also symbolic. As values, they must also embody some story or narrative. Churches have guys in robes dipping bread in wine or grape juice and feeding it to a bunch of people to represent the body of Christ. The symbolism represents Christ's sacrifice. He didn't deserve it. For our salvation, neither do we, but that's why it's powerful. Countries create rituals around their founding or around wars they've won or lost. We march in parades and wave flags and shoot off fireworks, and there's a shared sense that it all signifies something valuable and worthwhile. Married couples create their own little rituals and habits, their inside jokes, all to reaffirm the relationship's value, their own private interpersonal religion. Rituals connect us with the past, they connect us to our values, and they affirm who we are. Rituals are usually about some sacrifice. Back in the old days, priests and chiefs would actually kill people on an altar, sometimes ripping out their still beating hearts, and people would be screaming and banging on drums and doing all kinds of crazy shit. These sacrifices were made to appease an angry god, or ensure a good harvest, or bring about any other number of desired outcomes. But the real reason for ritual sacrifice was deeper than that. Let me explain. Humans are actually horribly guilt-ridden creatures. Let's say you find a wallet with $100 in it, but no ID or any other info about whom it belongs to. No one is around, and you have no clue how to find the owner. So you keep it. Newton's first law of emotion states that every action produces an equal and opposite emotional reaction. In this case, something good happens to you without your deserving it. Cue guilt. Now think of it this way. You exist. You didn't do anything to deserve existing. You don't even know why you started existing. You just did. Boom, you have a life. And you have no idea where it came from or why. If you believe God gave it to you, then holy shit, do you owe him big time. But even if you don't believe in God, damn, you're blessed with life. What did you ever do to deserve that? How can you live in such a way as to make your life worthwhile? This is the constant yet unanswerable question of the human condition, and why the inherent guilt of consciousness is the cornerstone of almost every spiritual religion. The sacrifices that pop up in ancient spiritual religions were enacted to give their adherents a feeling of repaying that debt, of living that worthwhile life. Though back in the day, they'd actually sacrifice human beings, a life for a life, eventually people smartened up and realized that you could symbolically sacrifice a life, Jesus's or whoever's, for the salvation of all mankind. That way, we didn't have to keep cleaning blood off the altar every other day. And the flies, don't even get me started on the flies. Most religious practices are developed for the alleviation of guilt. You could even say that that's really all prayer is, miniature episodes of guilt alleviation. You don't pray to God to say, fuck yeah, I'm awesome. No, prayer is like a gratitude journal before there were gratitude journals. Thanks, God, for letting me exist, even though it sucks to be me sometimes. I'm sorry I thought and did all those bad things. Boom, sense of guilt absolves, at least for a while. Ideological religions handle the guilt question far more efficiently than spiritual ones. Nations direct people's feelings of existential guilt towards service. Our country gave you these opportunities, so put on a damn uniform and fight to protect them. Right-wing ideologies usually perceive necessary sacrifice in terms of protecting one's family and country. Left-wing ideologies usually see necessary sacrifice as giving up for the greater good of all society. Finally, in interpersonal religions, sacrificing oneself generates a sense of romance and loyalty. Think about marriage. I mean, you stand at an altar and promise to give your life to this other person. We all struggle with the sense that we deserve to be loved. Even if your parents were awesome, you sometimes wonder, wow, why me? What did I do to deserve this? Interpersonal religions have all sorts of rituals and sacrifices designed to make people feel they deserve to be loved. Rings, gifts, anniversaries, wiping the piss off the floor when I miss the toilet. It's the little things that add up to one big thing. You're welcome, honey. How to start your own religion. Step 5. Promise heaven, deliver hell. If you've made it this far in starting your own religion, it means you've assembled a nice group of hopeless people desperately avoiding the uncomfortable truth by studying a bunch of bullshit you've made up, ignoring their friends, and telling their families to fuck off. Now it's time to get serious. The beauty of a religion is that the more you promise your followers salvation, enlightenment, world peace, perfect happiness, or whatever, the more they will fail to live up to that promise. And the more they fail to live up to that promise, and the more they blame themselves and feel guilty, the more they'll do whatever you tell them to do to make up for it. Some people might call this the cycle of psychological abuse, but let's not let such terms ruin our fun. Pyramid schemes do this really well. You give a scumbag some money for a bunch of products you don't want or need, and then you spend the next 3 months desperately trying to get other people to sign up for the scheme under you, and also buy and sell products nobody wants or needs. And it doesn't work. Then, instead of recognizing the obvious, the product is one big scam, selling a scam to sell more scams, you blame yourself. Because, look, the guy at the top of the pyramid has a Ferrari, and you want a Ferrari, so clearly the problem must be you, right? Fortunately, that guy with the Ferrari has graciously agreed to put on a seminar to help you sell more crap nobody wants to people who will then try to sell more crap nobody wants to more people who will sell it, and so on. And at said seminar, most of the time is spent psyching you up with music and chants and creating an us versus them dichotomy. Winners never give up. Losers believe it won't work for them. And you come away from the seminar really motivated and pumped, but still with no idea how to sell anything, especially crap nobody wants. And instead of getting pissed off at the money-based religion you've bought into, you get pissed off at yourself. You blame yourself for failing to live up to your God value, regardless of how ill-advised that God value is. You can see this same cycle of desperation play out in all sorts of areas. Fitness and diet plans, political activism, self-help seminars, financial planning, visiting your grandmother on a holiday. The message is always the same. The more you do it, the more you're told you need to do it to finally experience the satisfaction you've been promised. Yet that satisfaction never comes. Look, time out for a second. Let me be the one to break the bad news to you. Human pain is like a game of whack-a-mole. Every time you knock down one kind of pain, another one pops up. And the faster you whack them, the faster they come back. The pain may get better, it may change shape, it may be less catastrophic each time, but it will always be there. It's part of us. It is us. A lot of religious spokespeople out there make a lot of money claiming they can beat the pain whack-a-mole game for you, once and for all. But the truth is that there is no end to the pain moles. The faster you hit them, the faster they come back. And that's how all the douche canoes in the religion game stay in business so long. Instead of admitting that the game is rigged, that our human nature is fundamentally designed to generate pain, they blame you for not winning the game. Or worse, they blame some nebulous them. If we could just get rid of them, we'd all stop suffering. Pinky swear. But that doesn't work either. That just transfers the pain from one population to another and amplifies it. Because seriously, if someone really could solve all your problems, they'd go out of business by next Tuesday or get voted out of office next week. Leaders need their followers to be perpetually dissatisfied. It's good for the leadership business. If everything were perfect and great, there'd be no reason to follow anybody. No religion will ever make you feel blissful and peaceful all the time. No country will ever feel completely fair and safe. No political philosophy will solve everyone's problems all the time. True equality can never be achieved. Someone somewhere will always be screwed over. True freedom doesn't really exist because we all must sacrifice some autonomy for stability. No one, no matter how much you love them or they love you, will ever absolve that internal guilt you feel simply for existing. It's all fucked. Everything is fucked. It always has been and always will be. There are no solutions, only stopgap measures, only incremental improvements, only slightly better forms of fuckedness than others. And it's time we stop running from that and instead embrace it. This is our fucked up world. And we're the fucked up ones in it. How to start your own religion. Step 6. Profit for profit. So this is it. You've come to the end. You have your religion, and now it's time to reap all of its benefits. Now that you've got your little following giving you their money and cutting your grass, you can finally have everything you ever wished for. Want a dozen sex slaves? Just say the word. Make up a scripture. Tell your followers that stage 6 of manatee enlightenment can only be found in the prophet's orgasms. Want a huge piece of land out in the middle of nowhere? Just tell your followers that only you can build paradise for them, and it needs to be really far away. Oh, and by the way, they need to pay for it. Want power and prestige? Tell your followers to vote you into office. Or even better, overthrow the government with violence. If you do your job well, they should be willing to give up their lives for you. The opportunities really are endless. No more loneliness, no more relationship problems, no more financial woes. You can fulfill your wildest dreams. You just have to trample on the hopes and dreams of thousands of others to get there. Yes, my friend, you've worked hard for this. Therefore, you deserve all the benefits without any meddlesome social concerns or pedantic arguments about ethics and whatnot, because that's what you get to do when you start your own religion. You get to decide what is ethical. You get to decide what is right. And you get to decide who is righteous. Maybe this whole start a religion thing makes you squirm. Well, I hate to break it to you, but you're already in one. Whether you realize it or not, you've adopted some group's beliefs and values. You participate in the rituals and offer up the sacrifices. You draw the us versus them lines and intellectually isolate yourself. This is what we all do. Religious beliefs and their constituent tribal behaviors are a fundamental part of our nature. It's impossible not to adopt them. If you think you're above religion, that you use logic and reason, I'm sorry to say, you're wrong. You are one of us. If you think you're well-informed and highly educated, you're not. You still suck. We all must have faith in something. We must find value somewhere. It's how we psychologically survive and thrive. It's how we find hope. And even if you have a vision for a better future, it's too hard to go it alone. To realize any dream, we need support networks for both emotional and logistical reasons. It takes an army, literally. It's our value hierarchies, as expressed through the stories of religion and shared among thousands or millions, that attract, organize, and propel human systems forward in a sort of Darwinian competition. Religions compete in the world for resources, and the religions that tend to win out are those whose value hierarchies make the most efficient use of labor and capital. And as it wins out, more and more people adopt the winning religion's value hierarchy, as it has demonstrated the most value to individuals in the population. These victorious religions then stabilize and become the foundation for culture. But here's the problem. Every time a religion succeeds, every time it spreads its message far and wide and comes to dominate a huge swath of human emotion and endeavor, its values change. The religion's God value no longer comprises the principles that inspired the religion in the first place. Its God value slowly shifts and becomes the preservation of the religion itself, not to lose what it has gained. And this is where the corruption begins. When the original values that define the religion, the movement, the revolution, get tossed aside for the sake of maintaining the status quo, this is narcissism at an organizational level. This is how you go from Jesus to the Crusades, from Marxism to the gulags, from a wedding chapel to divorce court. This corruption of the religion's original values rots away at the religion's following, thus leading to the rising up of newer, reactionary religions that eventually conquer the original one. Then the whole process begins again. In this sense, success is in many ways far more precarious than failure. One, because the more you gain, the more you have to lose. And the more you have to lose, the harder it is to maintain hope. But more importantly, because by experiencing our hopes, we lose them. We see that our beautiful visions for a perfect future are not so perfect. That our dreams and aspirations are themselves riddled with unexpected flaws and unforeseen sacrifices. Because the only thing that can ever truly destroy a dream is to have it come true. Chapter 5. Hope is fucked. In the late 19th century, during a mild and glorious summer in the Swiss Alps, a hermetic philosopher, a self-anointed dynamite of mind and spirit, metaphorically came down off his mountaintop and with his own money published a book. The book was his gift to mankind, a gift that stood boldly upon the doorstep of the modern world and announced the words that would make the philosopher famous long after his death. It announced, "God is dead," and more. It announced that the echoes of this death would be the harbinger of a new and dangerous age that would challenge us all. The philosopher spoke these words as a warning. He spoke them as a watchman. He spoke for us all. Yet, the book sold fewer than 40 copies. Mette von Salis woke before dawn to light the fire to boil water for the philosopher's tea. She fetched ice to cool the blankets for his achy joints. She gathered bones from yesterday's dinner to begin stewing a broth that would settle his stomach. She hand-washed his soiled linens, and soon he would need his hair cropped and his mustache trimmed, and she realized she had forgotten to fetch a new razor. This was Meta's third summer caring for Friedrich Nietzsche, and probably, she figured, her last. She loved him, as a brother, that is. When a mutual friend suggested they marry, they both laughed uproariously, and then became nauseated. But Meta was approaching the limits of her charity. She had met Nietzsche at a dinner party. She listened to him play piano and tell jokes and rambunctious stories of his antics with his old friend, composer Richard Wagner. Unlike in his writing, Nietzsche was polite and mild in person. He was an affectionate listener. He was a lover of poetry and could recite dozens of verses from memory. He'd sit and play word games for hours, sing songs and make puns. Nietzsche was disarmingly brilliant, a mind so sharp he could slice a room open with only a few words. Aphorisms that would later become world famous seemed to spill out of him like fogged breath in cold air. Talking too much about yourself can also be a means to conceal yourself, he would spontaneously add, quickly silencing the room. Meta often found herself speechless in his presence, not because of any overwhelmed emotion, but merely because her mind felt as though it were constantly a few paces behind his and needed a moment to catch up. Yet, Meta was no intellectual slouch. In fact, she was a badass of her time. Meta was the first woman to ever earn a PhD in Switzerland. She was also one of the world's leading feminist writers and activists. She spoke four languages fluently and published articles all over Europe arguing for women's rights, a radical idea at the time. She was well-traveled, brilliant, and headstrong. And when she stumbled upon Nietzsche's work, she felt she had finally found someone whose ideas could push women's liberation out into the world. Here was a man who argued for the empowerment of the individual, for radical personal responsibility. Here was a man who believed that individual aptitude mattered more than anything, that each human not only deserved expansion into his or her full potential, but had the duty to exercise and push for that expansion. Nietzsche put into words, Meta believed, the core ideas and conceptual frameworks that would ultimately empower women and lead them out of their perpetual servitude. But there was only one problem. Nietzsche wasn't a feminist. In fact, he found the whole idea of women's liberation ridiculous. This didn't deter Meta. He was a man of reason. He could be persuaded. He simply needed to recognize his own prejudice and be freed from it. She began visiting him regularly, and soon they became close friends and intellectual companions. They spent summers in Switzerland, winters in France and Italy, forays into Venice, quick trips doubling back to Germany and then Switzerland again. As the years wore on, Meta discovered that behind Nietzsche's penetrating eyes and gigantic mustache was a bundle of contradictions. He wrote obsessively of power while being himself frail and weak. He preached radical responsibility and self-reliance, despite being wholly dependent on mostly female friends and family to take care of and support him. He cursed the fickle reviewers and academics who panned his work or refused to read it, while simultaneously boasting that his lack of popular success only proved his brilliance. As he once proclaimed, "My time has not come yet. Some men are born posthumously." Nietzsche was, in fact, everything he claimed to loathe, weak, dependent, and wholly captivated and reliant on powerful, independent women. Yet, in his work, he preached individual strength and self-reliance and was a woeful misogynist. His lifelong dependence on the care of women seemed to blur his ability to see them clearly. It would be the glaring blind spot in the vision of an otherwise prophetic man. If there was a hall of fame for most pain tolerated by a single individual, I would nominate Nietzsche as one of its first cornerstone inductees. He was continually sick as a child. Doctors applied leeches to his neck and ears and told him to spend hours without moving. He'd inherited a neurological disorder that brought about debilitating migraines throughout his life and caused him to go mad in middle age. He was also incredibly sensitive to light, unable to go outside without thick blue-tinted glasses, and would be nearly blind by the age of 30. As a young man, he would join the military and serve briefly in the Franco-Prussian War. There, he would contract diphtheria and dysentery, which would almost kill him. The treatment at the time was acid enemas, which destroyed his digestive tract. For the rest of his life, he would struggle with acute digestive pain, was never able to eat large meals, and was incontinent for parts of his life. An injury from his cavalry days left parts of his body inflexible and, on his worst days, immovable. He often needed help standing up and would spend months at a time stuck alone in bed, unable to open his eyes due to the pain. In 1880, what he would later call a bad year, he was bedridden 260 out of 365 days. He spent most of his life migrating between the French coast in the winter in the Swiss Alps in the summer, as he required mild temperatures to keep his bones and joints from aching. Meta quickly discovered that she wasn't the only intellectual woman fascinated by this man. He had a parade of women coming by to take care of him for weeks or months at a time. Like Meta, these women were badasses of their time. They were professors and wealthy landowners and entrepreneurs. They were educated and multilingual and fiercely independent. And they were feminists, the earliest feminists. They, too, had seen the liberating message in Nietzsche's work. He wrote of social structures crippling the individual. Feminists argued that the social structures of the age imprisoned them. He denounced the church for rewarding the weak and mediocre. Feminists, too, denounced the church for forcing women into marriage and subservience to men. And he dared to recast the story of human history, not as man's escape from and dominance over nature, but as mankind's growing ignorance to its own nature. He argued that the individual must empower himself and access higher levels of freedom and consciousness. These women saw feminism as the next step to that higher liberation. Nietzsche filled them all with hope, and they took turns caring for this deteriorating, broken man, hopeful that the next book, the next essay, the next polemic would be the one that broke open the floodgates. But for most of his life, his work was almost universally ignored. Then Nietzsche announced the death of God, and he went from failing university professor to pariah. He was unemployable and basically homeless. No one wanted anything to do with him. No university, no publisher, not even many of his friends. He scrounged together money to publish his work himself, borrowing from his mother and sister to survive. He relied on friends to manage his life for him, and even then, his books hardly sold a copy. Yet despite it all, these women stuck with him. They cleaned him and fed him and carried him. They believed there was something in this decrepit man that could potentially change history, and so they waited. A Brief History of the World, According to Nietzsche. Let's say you drop a bunch of people onto a plot of land with limited resources and have them start a civilization from scratch. Here's what happens. Some people are naturally more gifted than others. Some are smarter. Some are bigger and stronger. Some are more charismatic. Some are friendly and get along easily with others. Some work harder and come up with better ideas. The people with natural advantages will accumulate more resources than others. And because they have more resources, they will have a disproportionate amount of power within this new society. They will be able to use that power to garner more resources and more advantages, and so on. You know, the whole rich get richer thing. Run this through enough generations, and pretty soon you have a social hierarchy, with a small number of elites at the top and a large number of people getting completely hosed at the bottom. Since the advent of agriculture, all human societies have exhibited this stratification. And all societies must deal with the tension that emerges between the advantaged elite and the disadvantaged masses. Nietzsche called the elite the masters of society, as they have almost complete control over wealth, production, and political power. He called the working masses the slaves of society, because he saw little difference between a laborer working his whole life for a small sum and slavery itself. Now here's where it gets interesting. Nietzsche argued that the masters of society would come to see their privilege as well-deserved. That is, they would craft value narratives to justify their elite status. Life was a competition, and they had won it. Why shouldn't they be rewarded for it? It was good they were on top. They deserved it. They were the smartest, strongest, and most talented. Therefore, they were the most righteous. Nietzsche called this belief system, in which those who end up ahead do so because they deserve it, master morality. Master morality is the moral belief that people get what they deserve. It's the moral belief that might makes right, that if you earn something through hard work or ingenuity, you deserve it. No one can take that from you, nor should they. You are the best, and because you've demonstrated superiority, you should be rewarded for it. Conversely, Nietzsche argued the slaves of society would generate a moral code of their own. Whereas the masters believed they were righteous and virtuous because of their strength, the slaves of society came to believe that they were righteous and virtuous because of their weakness. Slave morality believes that people who have suffered the most, those who are the most disadvantaged and exploited, deserve the best treatment because of that suffering. Slave morality believes that it's the poorest and most unfortunate who deserve the most sympathy and the most respect. Whereas master morality believes in the virtue of strength and dominance, slave morality believes in the virtue of sacrifice and submission. While master morality believes in the necessity of hierarchy, slave morality believes in the necessity of equality. While master morality is generally represented by right-wing political beliefs, slave morality is usually found in left-wing political beliefs. We all contain both these moralities within us. Imagine you're in a class at school, and you study your ass off and get the highest test score. And because you got the highest test score, you're awarded benefits due to your success. You feel morally justified having those benefits. After all, you worked hard and earned them. You are a good student and a good person for being a good student. This is master morality. Now imagine that you have a classmate. This classmate has 18 siblings, all being raised by a single mother. This classmate works multiple part-time jobs and is never able to study because she is literally putting food on the table for her brothers and sisters. She fails the same exam that you passed with flying colors. Is that fair? No, it's not. You would probably feel that she deserves some sort of special exemption due to her situation. Maybe a chance to retake the test or to take it at a later date, when she has time to study for it. She deserves this because she is a good person for her sacrifices and disadvantages. This is slave morality. In Newtonian terms, master morality is the intrinsic desire to create a moral separation between ourselves and the world around us. It is the desire to create moral gaps with us on top. Slave morality is then an intrinsic desire to equalize, to close the moral gap and alleviate suffering. Both are fundamental components of our feeling brain's operating system. Both generate and perpetuate strong emotions, and both give us hope. Nietzsche argued that the cultures of the ancient world, Greek, Roman, Egyptian, Indian, and so on, were master morality cultures. They were structured to celebrate strength and excellence even at the expense of millions of slaves and subjects. They were warrior civilizations. They celebrated guts, glory, and bloodshed. Nietzsche also argued that the Judeo-Christian ethic of charity, pity, and compassion ushered slave morality to prominence and continued to dominate Western civilization up through his own time. For Nietzsche, these two value hierarchies were in constant tension and opposition. They were, he believed, at the root of all political and social conflict throughout history. And, he warned, that conflict was about to get much worse. Each religion is a faith-based attempt to explain reality in such a way that it gives people a steady stream of hope. In a kind of Darwinian competition, those religions that mobilize, coordinate, and inspire their believers the most are those that win out and spread throughout the world. In the ancient world, pagan religions built on master morality justified the existence of emperors and warrior kings who swept across the planet, expanding and consolidating territory and people. Then, about 2,000 years ago, Slave morality religions emerged and slowly began to take their place. These new religions were usually monotheistic and were not limited to one nation, race, or ethnic group. They preached their message to everyone because their message was one of equality. All people were either born good and later corrupted, or were born sinners and had to be saved. Either way, the result was the same. Everyone, regardless of nation, race, or creed, had to be converted in the name of the one true God. Then, in the 17th century, a new religion began to emerge in Europe, a religion that would unleash forces more powerful than anything seen in human history. Every religion runs into the sticky problem of evidence. You can tell people all this great stuff about God and spirits and angels and whatnot, but if the entire town burns down and your kid loses an arm in a fishing accident, well then, oops, where was God? Throughout history, authorities have expended a lot of effort to hide the lack of evidence supporting their religion, and or to punish anyone who dared question the validity of their faith-based values. It's for this reason that, like most atheists, Nietzsche loathed spiritual religions. Natural philosophers, as scientists were called in Isaac Newton's time, decided that the most reliable faith-based beliefs were those that had the most evidence supporting them. Evidence became the God value, and any belief that was no longer supported by evidence had to be altered to account for the new observed reality. This produced a new religion, science. Science is arguably the most effective religion because it is the first religion that is able to evolve and improve upon itself. It is open to anybody and everybody. It is not moored to a single book or creed. It is not beholden to some ancient land or people. It is not tethered to a supernatural spirit whose existence cannot be proven or disproven. It is an ongoing, ever-changing body of evidence-based beliefs, one that is free to mutate, grow, and shift as the evidence dictates. The scientific revolution changed the world more than anything before or since. It has reshaped the planet, lifted billions out of disease and poverty, and improved every aspect of life. It is not an exaggeration to suggest that science may be the only demonstrably good thing humanity has ever done for itself. Thank you, Francis Bacon. Thank you, Isaac Newton, you fucking titans. Science is singularly responsible for all the greatest inventions and advances in human history, from medicine and agriculture to education and commerce. But science did something else even more spectacular. It introduced the world to the concept of growth. For most of human history, growth wasn't a thing. Change occurred so slowly that everyone died in pretty much the same economic condition they were born in. The average human from 2,000 years ago experienced about as much economic growth in his lifetime as we experience in 6 months today. People would live their entire lives and nothing changed, no new developments, inventions, or technologies. People would live and die on the same land, among the same people, using the same tools, and nothing ever got better. In fact, things like plagues and famine and war and dickhead rulers with large armies often made everything worse. It was a slow, grueling, miserable existence. And with no prospect for change or a better life in this lifetime, people drew their hope from spiritual promises of a better life in the next lifetime. Spiritual religions flourished and dominated daily life. Everything revolved around the church, or synagogue, or temple, or mosque, or whatever. Priests and holy men were the arbiters of social life because they were the arbiters of hope. They were the only ones who could tell you what God wanted, and God was the only one who could promise any salvation or a better future. Therefore, these holy men dictated everything that was of value in society. Then science happened, and shit got cray-cray. Microscopes and printing presses and internal combustion engines and cotton gins and thermometers, and finally, some goddamn medicine that actually worked. Suddenly, life got better. More important, you could see life getting better. People used better tools, had access to more food, were healthier, and made more money. Finally, you could look back 10 years and say, "Whoa, can you believe we used to live like that?" And that ability to look back and see progress to see growth happen changed how people viewed the future. It changed how they viewed themselves, forever. Now you didn't have to wait until death to improve your lot. You could improve it here and now. And this implied all sorts of wonderful things. Freedom, for one. How are you going to choose to grow today? And also, responsibility. Because if you could now control your destiny, you had to take responsibility for that destiny. And, of course, equality. Because if a big patriarchal god isn't dictating who deserves what, that must mean that either no one deserves anything, or everyone deserves everything. These were concepts that had never been voiced before. With the prospect of so much growth and change in this lifetime, people no longer relied on spiritual beliefs about the next life to give them hope. Instead, they began to invent and rely upon the ideological religions of their time. This changed everything. Church doctrines softened. People stayed home on Sundays. Monarchs conceded power to their subjects. Philosophers began to openly question God, and somehow weren't burned alive for doing so. It was a golden age for human thought and progress. And incredibly, the progress begun in that age has only accelerated and continues to accelerate to this day. The scientific revolution eroded the dominance of spiritual religions and made way for the dominance of ideological religions. And this is what concerned Nietzsche, because for all the progress and wealth and tangible benefits that ideological religions produce, they lack something that spiritual religions do not: infallibility. Once believed in, a supernatural deity is impervious to worldly affairs. Your town could burn down. Your mother could make $1 million and then lose it all again. You could watch wars and diseases come and go. None of these experiences directly contradicts a belief in a deity, because supernatural entities are evidence-proof. And while atheists see this as a bug, it can also be a feature. The robustness of spiritual religions means that shit could hit the proverbial fan, and your psychological stability would remain intact. Hope can be preserved because God is always preserved. Not so with ideologies. If you spend a decade of your life lobbying for certain governmental reform, and then that reform leads to the death of tens of thousands of people, that's on you. That piece of hope that sustained you for years is shattered. Your identity, destroyed. Hello, darkness, my old friend. Ideologies, because they're constantly challenged, changed, proven, and then disproven, offer scant psychological stability upon which to build one's hope. And when the ideological foundation of our belief systems and value hierarchies is shaken, it throws us into the maw of the uncomfortable truth. Nietzsche was on top of this before anybody else. He warned of the coming existential malaise that technological growth would bring upon the world. In fact, this was the whole point of his God is dead proclamation. God is dead was not some obnoxious atheistic gloating, as it is usually interpreted today. No, it was a lament, a warning, a cry for help. Who are we to determine the meaning and significance of our own existence? Who are we to decide what is good and right in the world? How can we bear this burden? Nietzsche, understanding that existence is inherently chaotic and unknowable, believed that we are not psychologically equipped to handle the task of explaining our cosmic significance. He saw the spate of ideological religions that spewed forth in the Enlightenment's wake: democracy, nationalism, communism, socialism, colonialism, etc., as merely postponing the inevitable existential crisis of mankind. And he hated them all. He found democracy to be naive, nationalism stupid, communism appalling, colonialism offensive. Because, in a kind of backward Buddhist way, Nietzsche believed that any worldly attachment to gender, race, ethnicity, nationality, or history was a mirage, a make-believe, faith-based construct designed to suspend us high over the chasm of the uncomfortable truth by a thin rope of meaning. And ultimately, he believed that all these constructs were destined to conflict with one another and cause far more violence than they solved. Nietzsche predicted coming conflicts between the ideologies built on master and slave moralities. He believed that these conflicts would wreak greater destruction upon the world than anything else seen in human history. He predicted that this destruction would not be limited to national borders or different ethnic groups. It would transcend all borders. It would transcend country and people. Because these conflicts, these wars, would not be for God. They would be between gods, and the gods would be us. Pandora's Box. In Greek mythology, the world started out with only men. Everyone drank a lot and didn't do any work. It was one big, everlasting frat party. The ancient Greeks called this paradise, but if you ask me, it sounds like a special kind of hell. The gods, recognizing that this was a fairly boring state of affairs, decided to spice up the situation a bit. They wanted to create a companion for mankind, someone who would command all of men's attention, someone who would introduce complication and uncertainty to the easy life of shotgunning beer cans and playing foosball all night. So they decided to create the first woman. For this project, every one of the major gods helped out. Aphrodite gave her beauty, Athena gave her wisdom, Hera gave her the ability to create a family, Hermes gave her charismatic speech. On and on, the gods installed gifts and talents and intrigues into woman like apps in a new iPhone. The result was Pandora. The gods sent Pandora to Earth to introduce competition and sex and babies and arguments about the toilet seat. But the gods did something else, too. They sent her with a box. It was a beautiful box, embossed in gold and covered in intricate and delicate designs. The gods told Pandora to give the box to men, but also instructed her that it could never be opened. Spoiler alert, people suck. Somebody opened Pandora's box. Surprise, surprise, the men would all blame the woman for it. And out flew all the evils into the world. Death, disease, hatred, envy, and Twitter. The bucolic sausage party was no more. Now men could kill each other, and more importantly, now men had something to kill each other for, women, and the resources that attracted women. Thus began the stupid dick-measuring contest, also known as human history. Wars started, kingdoms and rivalries arose, slavery happened, emperors started conquering one another, leaving hundreds of thousands slaughtered in their wake. Entire cities were built and then destroyed. Meanwhile, women were treated as property, traded and bartered among the men like fishing nets or something. Basically, humans started being humans. Everything appeared to be fucked, but in the bottom of that box, there remained something shiny and beautiful. There remained hope. There are many interpretations of the myth of Pandora's box, the most common being that while the gods punished us with all the evils of the world, they also equipped us with the one antidote to those evils, hope. Think of it as the yin and the yang of mankind's eternal struggle. Everything is always fucked, but the more fucked things become, the more we must mobilize hope to sustain and overcome the world's fuckedness. This is why heroes such as Witold Pilecki inspire us. Their ability to muster enough hope to resist evil reminds us that all of us are capable of resisting evil. The sickness may spread, but so does the cure, because hope is contagious. Hope is what saves the world. But here's another, less popular interpretation of the Pandora's box myth. What if hope is not the antidote to evil? What if hope is just another form of evil? What if hope just got left in the box? Because hope didn't just inspire Pilecki's heroics. Hope also inspired the communist revolutions and the Nazi genocides. Hitler hoped to exterminate the Jews to bring about an evolutionarily superior human race. The Soviets hoped to instigate a global revolution to unite the world in true equality under communism. And let's be honest, most of the atrocities committed by the Western capitalist societies over the past 100 years were done in the name of hope. Hope for greater global economic freedom and wealth. Like a surgeon's scalpel, hope can save a life and hope can take a life. It can uplift us and it can destroy us. Just as there are healthy and damaging forms of confidence and healthy and damaging forms of love, there are also healthy and damaging forms of hope, and the difference between the two is not always clear. So far, I've argued that hope is fundamental to our psychology, that we need to A, have something to look forward to, B, believe ourselves in control of our fate enough to achieve that something, and C, find a community to achieve it with us. When we lack one or all of these for too long, we lose hope and spiral into the void of the uncomfortable truth. Experiences generate emotions. Emotions generate values. Values generate narratives of meaning. And people who share similar narratives of meaning come together to generate religions. The more effective or affective a religion, the more industrious and disciplined the adherents. And the more industrious and disciplined the adherents, the more likely the religion is to spread to other people, to give them a sense of self-control and a feeling of hope. These religions grow and expand and eventually define in-groups versus out-groups, create rituals and taboos, and spur conflict between groups with opposing values. These conflicts must exist because they maintain the meaning and purpose for people within the group. Therefore, it is the conflict that maintains the hope. So, we've got it backward. Everything being fucked doesn't require hope. Hope requires everything being fucked. The sources of hope that give our lives a sense of meaning are the same sources of division and hate. The hope that brings the most joy to our lives is the same hope that brings the greatest danger. The hope that brings people closest together is often the same hope that tears them apart. Hope is, therefore, destructive. Hope depends on the rejection of what currently is. Because hope requires that something be broken. Hope requires that we renounce a part of ourselves and or a part of the world. It requires us to be anti-something. Otherwise, we hope for nothing. This paints an unbelievably bleak picture of the human condition. It means that our psychological makeup is such that our only choices in life are between either perpetual conflict or nihilism. Tribalism or isolation. Religious war or the uncomfortable truth. Nietzsche believed that none of the ideologies generated by the scientific revolution would hold up in the long run. He believed that one by one, they would slowly kill each other off and or collapse from within. Then, after a couple of centuries, the real existential crisis would begin. Master morality would have been corrupted. Slave morality would have imploded. We would have failed ourselves. For human frailties are such that everything we produce must be impermanent and unreliable. Nietzsche instead believed that we must look beyond hope. We must look beyond values. We must evolve into something beyond good and evil. For him, this morality of the future had to begin with something he called amor fati, or love of one's fate. My formula for greatness in a human being, he wrote, is amor fati, that one wants nothing to be different, not forward, not backward, not in all eternity, not merely bear what is necessary, still less conceal it. All idealism is mendacity in the face of what is necessary, but love it. Amor fati, for Nietzsche, meant the unconditional acceptance of all life and experience, the highs and the lows, the meaning and the meaninglessness. It meant loving one's pain, embracing one's suffering. It meant closing the separation between one's desires and reality, not by striving for more desires, but by simply desiring reality. It basically meant hope for nothing, hope for what already is, because hope is ultimately empty. Anything your mind can conceptualize is fundamentally flawed and limited, and therefore damaging if worshipped unconditionally. Don't hope for more happiness. Don't hope for less suffering. Don't hope to improve your character. Don't hope to eliminate your flaws. Hope for this. Hope for the infinite opportunity and oppression present in every single moment. Hope for the suffering that comes with freedom, for the pain that comes from happiness, for the wisdom that comes from ignorance, for the power that comes from surrender. And then, act despite it. This is our challenge, our calling, to act without hope, to to not hope for better, to be better, in this moment and the next, and the next and the next. Everything is fucked, and hope is both the cause and the effect of that fuckedness. This is hard to swallow, because weaning ourselves off the sweet nectar of hope is like pulling a bottle away from a drunk. Without it, we believe we'll fall back into the void and be swallowed by the abyss. The uncomfortable truth frightens us, and so we spin stories and values and narratives and myths and legends about ourselves and the world to keep that truth at bay. But the only thing that frees us is that truth. You and I and everyone we know will die, and little to nothing that we do will ever matter on a cosmic scale. And while some people fear this truth will liberate them from all responsibility, that they'll go snort an 8-ball of cocaine and play in traffic, the reality is that this truth scares them because it liberates us to responsibility. It means that there's no reason to not love ourselves and love one another, that there's no reason to not treat ourselves and our planet with respect, that there's no reason to not live every moment of our lives as though it were to be lived in eternal recurrence. The second half of this book is an attempt to understand what a life without hope might look like. The first thing I'll say is that it's not as bad as you think. In fact, I believe it is better than the alternative. The second half of this book is also an honest look at the modern world and everything that is fucked with it. It's an evaluation done in the hope not of fixing it, but of coming to love it. Because we must break out of our cycle of religious conflict. We must emerge from our ideological cocoons. We must let the feeling brain feel, but deny it the stories of meaning and value that it so desperately craves. We must stretch beyond our conception of good and evil. We must learn to love what is. Amor Fati. It was Meta's last day in Sils Maria, Switzerland, and she planned to spend as much of it as she could outdoors. Friedrich's favorite walk was around the east bank of Lake Silvaplana, half a kilometer from town. The lake was a shimmering, crystalline thing this time of year, wreathed by the mountains on a horizon pulverized by white peaks. It was on walks around this lake that he and Meta had first bonded 4 summers ago. This was how she wanted to spend her last day with him. This was how she wanted to remember him. They left shortly after breakfast. The sun was perfect, and the air was silky. She led, and he hobbled along behind her with his walking stick. They passed barns and fields of cattle and a small sugar beet farm. Friedrich joked that the cows would be his most intellectual companions once Meta left. The two laughed and sang and picked walnuts as they went. They stopped and ate around noon, beneath a larch tree. It was then that Meta began to worry. They had come far in their excitement, much farther than she had anticipated, and now she could see that Friedrich was struggling, both physically and mentally, to keep it together. The walk back was arduous for him. He dragged noticeably now, and the reality of her leaving the next morning fell over them like an ominous moon, a pall upon their words. He had grown grumpy and achy. The stops were frequent, and he began muttering to himself. Not like this, Meta thought. She didn't want to leave him like this, but she must. It was late afternoon by the time they approached the village. The sun was waning, and the air was now a burden. Friedrich lagged by a good 20 meters, yet Meta knew that the only way to get him all the way home was by not stopping for him. They passed the same sugar beet farm, the same barn, and the same cattle, his new companions. "What was that?" Friedrich shouted. "Where has God gone, you say?" Meta turned around and knew what she would find before she even saw it. Friedrich, walking, stick waving in the air, shouting maniacally at a small group of cows chewing in front of him. "I shall tell you," he said, breathing heavily. He raised his stick and gestured to the mountains around. "We have killed him, you and I. We are his murderers. But how have we done this?" The cows chewed placidly. One swatted a fly with its tail. "How were we able to drink up the seas? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the horizon? What did we do when we unchained the earth from its sun? Are we not perpetually falling in all directions? Are we not straying as though through some infinite nothing? Friedrich, this is silly, Meta said, trying to grab his sleeve and pull him along. But he yanked his arm away. There was madness in his eyes. Where is God? God is dead.